Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. I'm excited about this next guest because he has a book, I believe, that bashed Marxism. And I love anybody who bashes Marxism. And once I woke up to how the economy operates to some degree, I realized that everything is pretty much fake and everything I was taught was actually a lie. And I think that this conversation is going to be interesting if you're out there and you share the same sentiment. The individual wrote a book called Debunking Economics. And if you guys want to pull it up, he actually has multiple books, but Steve Keen is here and has an incredible background. He even won the Paul Revere Award. So we got to talk about that. And his new one, The New Economics, a Manifesto. So it is an honor to have you here, sir, Steve Keen.
Thank you very much, Mark. Glad to be invited, and let's talk and see what the audience thinks as well.
Yeah, so let's start off with Debunking Economics. That's the one that caught my eye in the very beginning. It came out in 2001. It was revised in 2011. But from all the reviews, everything that I picked up about it, it says that you predicted the 2008 crash. Is that right?
Yeah. And the reason is I'm a non-orthodox economist. I've been a critic of mainstream economics for literally half a century now. And one thing that the mainstream ignores, funnily enough, is the banking system. And one thing that the non-orthodox side takes seriously is the banking system. And so I looked at the banking system at levels of private debt before the crisis came along and said, on the analysis that I built my academic career on, there has to be a crisis. And so somebody has to warn about it. At least in Australia, I was the person. So that's when I started warning about it late 2005 is when I began.
Wow. And so what is the Paul Revere Award?
That was something that's made up by the Real World Economics Review, because the economics you'll know for the Nobel Prize, for example, the Nobel Prize in Economics. Now, you might think that prize was invented by Alfred Nobel. Okay, most people do. It wasn't. That's bullshit. What actually happened, Nobel actually did consider creating a prize for economics and said no, because he didn't regard it as a science. So he had the prize for physics, the prize for chemistry, I think medicine, literature, and peace. So those are the prizes he created. Now, there was no Nobel Prize in economics, but in the late 1960s, there was a strong battle going on in Sweden over the social democratic reforms that the progressive parties wanted to bring in versus mainstream economics. And the Swedish Central Bank was on the side of mainstream economics, and to try to legitimize their fight with the social democratic parties in Sweden at the time, they invented what they called the Sveriges Riksbank Prize in economics in honor of Alfred Nobel, which they funded, wasn't funded by the Nobel Foundation. So it's a made-up bloody prize to basically done there to try to make mainstream economics look like a science. It's not. So there's no way I'll ever get the Nobel Prize for economics, because I'm saying what you guys do is garbage. Okay, so to bring up the question of who did and who didn't predict the financial crisis, and obviously no mainstream economists predicted the financial crisis. There's one possible exception, that's Robert Shiller, but the rest of them had no idea it was coming, completely caught by surprise. The non-orthodox people were talking about it being feasible, and they had a poll to say who did the best warning and whose work might be the most important to prevent another crisis. And there were three winners: myself, Nuriel Roubini, and Dean Baker. And I got the top number of votes by the Real World Economic Association.
And so for our audience, can you explain what conventional economics is and why you're against it? Because I think we're going to go with it, but what's the summary?
Yeah. It's basically stuff that says everything's driven by supply and demand. Okay. Alfred Marshall was the first person to really formalize that idea. And he talked about, you might as well debate whether the upper or the lower blade of a pair of scissors cuts paper as to debate whether supply or demand causes prices. And they basically argue that, you know, you have the intersection of supply curve and demand curve, and that determines where prices are set and where quantity is set. And that's the analysis which everybody accepts as economics. And when Marshall first came up with that idea back in the 1890s, it was valid as a hypothetical argument as to what would actually determine prices and quantities and set the output in the economy and so on. And every last element of that has been mathematically disproven since that point, partially by non-orthodox economists, partly by accident by mathematicians, partly by the orthodox economists themselves. But they're so wedded to that vision of the economy being a nice little equilibrium system with supply and demand working to achieve balance in all markets. But they've stuck with it and turned it from a potential science into an actual religion. And I'm doing my best to get rid of it because it's got no decent foundation, either mathematical logic or empirical data.
So the book that we talk a lot about in our groups is The Creature from Jekyll Island and the creation of the Federal Reserve. And I look at that as such an instrumental piece to not only American history, but to the world history. So the moment that happened, it seems like it's like money became fake, right? If it's not backed.
No, I'm sorry. No, that's wrong.
Okay, so explain.
Okay. There's a side in particularly libertarian economics that says money should be like gold. You know, we should have money should be an asset to the owner and a liability to no one. So the vision that most libertarians have is that gold should be money. Okay, and money should really be a certificate that gives you access to a certain amount of gold. It should all be based on gold. Okay? When you look at history and you look at anthropology, and there's a brilliant book by another, unfortunately deceased, very close friend of mine, David Graeber, called Debt: The First 5,000 Years. David died at the beginning of COVID. Looking at anthropology, the only time in which gold or silver has actually been money is when you've had social breakdown, like during the Hundred Years' War and the 30 Years' War in Europe, where you had a century of different principalities and kingdoms fighting each other. As you were a mercenary, and all those wars were fought largely by mercenaries, you wouldn't accept payment in the king's coin because the king might be dead and the other king won't honor it. So the only way to get paid was to be paid in gold or silver. So only during periods of social breakdown did gold or silver actually become money. And normally what happens is money is a creation of whatever state you're in at the time. The state will create coins, or in the English case, it'll create pieces of wood. Have you heard of tally sticks? Okay. Have you heard of the House of Lords? Big Ben.
Yes.
Okay. Big Ben. The reason that Big Ben exists is because in 1830 or something like that, the English government decided to destroy all the tally sticks, which were actually used as a form of commerce for paying taxes and debts and so on. A tally stick was a piece of wood. I forgot what type of wood it was, but it's wood that has a very distinctive grain. People would negotiate a contract. They'd then cut ridges into the wood to indicate the amount of money being owed and so on. They'd exchange one. They'd slit it down the middle. It was like cryptocurrency when you could only use biology for the cryptocurrency, okay? It was a unique record. And you would then, one person would hang on to the stub, okay? And the other person onto the butt. I've forgotten what the terms actually were. That was a major form of money, certainly for paying taxes, also for transactions and so on, in the United Kingdom and many other parts of the world as well, for centuries. And then when they invented paper money, this was around the 1820s, 1830s, and you started getting banknotes and so on, produced by the Bank of England. All these tally sticks stopped being used. They accumulated, and the decision was made to burn them. They thought it was embarrassing. We had this silly piece of wood, you know, rather than money or coins and so on. So they set them on fire in the basement of what was the Palace of Westminster, which was the predecessor to the Big Ben and so on, and it burnt the building down. Okay, so our record of this fact that pieces of wood, in a sense, a form of cryptocurrency, but basically a credit-based system, was the foundation of finance in the UK for several centuries, close to 10 centuries. That was lost in that particular historical accident. You can find a few examples of tally sticks if you go to the Bank of England and their museum there. But that was the form of money. So forget about it being based on gold and silver. This is one of the many, many myths in money in economics. And unfortunately, the mainstream economics, neoclassical economists, sort of perpetuate that myth. So we're all filled with mythical views of what money was and what money is, what money should be.
Yeah, I guess, you know, when you just break it down, and I'm assuming you're maybe an Adam Smith fan, maybe because you like the capitalistic approach. No, you're not a big Adam Smith fan. Okay, so basically, money is just what, stored labor? Is that how it's basically broken down?
No, it's basically a promise to pay of a third party, and that the best work on this is actually by a wonderful, recently also deceased, unfortunately, Italian economist called Augusto Graziani. A wonderful name, and Augusto was about 5 foot nothing. and with the only human being I've ever seen who can speak in perfectly formed paragraphs, a brilliant orator in English, and he's Italian. And he argued that what is a monetary economy? How do we define a monetary economy? He said, well, a monetary economy can't be something using a commodity as money, because if it's a commodity as money like gold or silver or cowrie shells or anything else, that's something which any individual can produce for themselves. So fundamentally, if you're talking about money, gold is silver as money, you've still got a barter economy. You're just using a particular commodity to enable exchanges for barter. So he said, in that case, a truly monetary economy must be using a token, something which has no real intrinsic value. And then he said, also, the token must be used, must be enabled to make a complete transfer of ownership. So if you transfer the token from yourself as the buyer to whoever you're buying something from as the seller, once that transfer is done, there's no more relationship left between you. So it can't be credit, okay? It must actually terminate a transaction. So if I buy something off Amazon and the Amazon sends it to me and then my bank fails, Amazon can't come back at me, I've already done the transaction. Okay? And then the third thing is, it can't give rights of seigniorage to the person, the entity producing that particular token. So it must be something which can't be, you can't go and print more of them yourself and go shopping with your own tokens. He said the only way to fulfill these conditions is that money has to be the promises of a third party that both parties to a transaction accept as being full fulfillment of the transaction. So he said, therefore, all exchanges are triangular. There's a buyer, a seller, and a bank. The transfer of the liability to the bank from the buyer to the seller closes the transaction. So that's a one commodity, not two. When you think about barter, people think about, you're bartering a mouse for a microphone for a mouse, and how many mouse per microphone. You've got two objects, you've got to work a relative price between the two. That's the neoclassical framework. Graziani said there's one commodity, so I'll bring up the microphone again. Only wants to sell the microphone, one commodity, a monetary price, and what actually happens is a transfer of bank accounts from the buyer to the seller. He said that's a monetary economy.
Hmm. Wow. Okay, so your viewpoints on Federal Reserve and then Nixon taking us off the gold standard. Overall, what's your thoughts on both of those events?
Well, the Federal Reserve is a clearinghouse. The fundamental thing a clearinghouse should do is just simply enable banks to settle transactions between themselves. That was the role of the Bank of England as well initially. So we need a clearinghouse. If you bank with a Bank of America and I bank with HSBC, then when you and make it, if I buy something off you, it's got to pass from my bank to your bank, which means they've got to have a bank which they settle. And this is where the triangular view comes in again, because you and I are doing a transaction. If we're at the same bank, you and I are at the base of the triangle and the bank itself is at the apex. But if you work for a different bank than I, then you've got to put another triangle on top of that. And that triangle fundamentally is the clearinghouse. And that's what the Federal Reserve's role should be. So you need them as part of a well-functioning monetary system. The trouble is they're run by mainstream economists, and that's where most of the problems come from.
Yeah. So when you look back at the creation, the people who were there, I mean, the original group of people, it just seems like the world started, it led to a lot of disagreement, which potentially started World War I. So, there's a lot that comes.
That's a bit of a stretch. I think World War I was coming anyway with the breakdown of the feudal system in Europe. And anyway, yeah.
But interesting timing. And there's all kinds of theories out there that some of the people who are a part of that, the only thing that was blocking them were a few really wealthy people who were, happened to be on the Titanic ship, which, have you ever heard of that conspiracy?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
So it's just pretty interesting how you can kind of line everything up. But when I look at some of the people who are part of it, it's pretty scary. I think they really impacted the world. So the gold standard, though, in 1971, when Nixon took us off the gold standard completely, it gave them a license to print, which, in my opinion, going back to classical economics, the more supply, the more it devalues the currency. Am I wrong about that?
Yes, you were wrong about that. Because again, you've got to look at the accounting of the economy and see who actually creates money. And when you look at who creates money, it's not the central bank, it's the treasury. The treasury creates money. Now, the other side, which you're also probably missing, is that people when you learn conventional economics, and this is the, Austrian economics falls into the same category, frankly, they treat banks as being basically warehouses. You know, you put your money into the warehouse and then I'll come along and borrow the money from the warehouse. So effectively, banks are just warehousing money, and that's their role. They don't actually create money. That, to use a technical term, is bullshit. Okay? Banks actually are bank money creators. The banks create money simply by putting an amount of money in your bank account and matching it with an amount of debt you owe to them. So banks create money by loans. Okay? And this is something which is finally recognized by central banks such as the Bank of England and the Bundesbank. They recognize that. Austrian economists hasn't caught up with it, and neoclassical economists ignore it, even though the Bank of England is now saying this is the case. So private banks create money, and the Treasury creates money as well. You've got both. We live in a mixed system with both credit-created money by banks and fiat-created money by the banking sector, but it's not the central bank that creates the money at that level. Okay? It facilitates the creation of money, but the actual creation of money is done by the Treasury.
Got it. Okay. And I was reading through some of the testimonials of your book, and you explain very well, even whenever it comes to banks, whenever there's a foreclosure, they just take back something that they actually never put money into, which is very fascinating, right? The way that's done.
That's the real danger. I mean, with all this focus upon the central bank, the Treasury, and the the Jekyll Island, et cetera, basically, it's private banks get away scot-free with fraud. Okay, and that's what actually happened during the financial crisis. So I ended up meeting everybody who was ever interviewed in The Big Short except Michael Berry after the whole event happened. And you look at what was going on there. It was absolutely fraudulent behavior by the private banks. And the real danger is not the central bank, which is really a conduit for Treasury creation of money. It's letting private banks create money, which they need a state license to do that, of course. Okay, but once they have the capacity to create money, they can make a fortune out of the actual capacity to create money by financing things like the subprime housing bubble. Now, looking back at that, people are saying, why are you saying there's a bubble that hasn't burst? I think it's only a bubble after it burst. Well, it burst, okay? And you saw the huge economic damage done to America and American society by that bubble. It's the private banks that get away with blue murder because of our treatment of them as though they're just warehouses when, in fact, they're money creators. And then the question is, what are they creating money for? Are they creating money for entrepreneurs like me? No. They're creating it for real estate speculators. And we get a bubble coming out of that, which then crashes the economy. So I'd be much more concerned about controlling the private banks than I would be controlling the Federal Reserve. The main problem with the Federal Reserve, it's controlled by people who wait for it, do not understand money.
And why is that? Because of no accountability? Because there will always be
No, because they've been trained by neoclassical economists who believe money doesn't matter. It's a real can of worms when you dive into economic theory and see what's going on versus what the real world is like. The textbooks are teaching you a whole series of myths.
Yes.
Okay. So the myth they teach in the textbooks is that banks are what they call intermediaries, financial intermediaries. So a bank enables savers to lend to borrowers. And then what that means is when borrowers borrow lots of money, it means savers have got less money to spend. So consequently, there can be this sort of a balancing effect. The increased spending power of the borrowers is offset by the lower spending power of the lenders. And then when borrowers repay, it goes the other way. So reduced spending power by borrowers, but increased spending power by savers. And overall, it cancels out, and you only get a major effect out of it if there's a big difference in spending rates by borrowers versus savers. And for that reason, Bernanke dismissed Irving Fisher's explanation for what caused the Great Depression. Now, when you look at the banks and say banks are actually money creators, then when they lend you for buying shares during the Great Depression, take a margin loan, please, that actually causes the inflation of the share market prices. Now, when you pay that margin debt down, or when you can't pay it and you go bankrupt, that destroys money. So the creation and destruction of money by the private banking sector is far more important than people's obsession about the central banks, which don't create money fundamentally, and far more important than money creation by the Treasury, because that's what treasuries do. So you've got the wrong bull by the wrong horns if you're focusing upon the central banks and you're ignoring both the private bank money creation and also the treasury.
So we're all about decentralization in our groups that we talk about.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the more control you have, the better, but the more centralized, the less control, really. So do you believe that, I mean, the entire system is rigged for a reason, right? To keep a certain group in power. And therefore, if it's centralized, those people always have power over, you know, inflation and basically the economy completely. So that's the way we look at it. Do you believe the same thing?
No. No, I think we live in a society. I mean, anybody who thinks that they're independent, okay, if you're living in a cave somewhere and you're, you know, getting your own water and you build your own tracks to get from whatever your production system is back again, then you're an individual. We are all living in societies, okay? And societies need rules by which we can communicate and engage with each other. And what you want is a society which enables those rules to be both productive and sustainable. So the libertarian really is an extreme that, if they're very extreme, you argue, I'm independent, I don't rely on anybody else. Well, okay, you were born, you gave birth to yourself, did you? et cetera, et cetera.
Good
there's
point.
A, there's a lot of right? there's
point.
A lot of huge myths in that libertarian way of thinking. What you have really is an extreme between a totally centralized system and a totally decentralized system. They're still inside a society. You're not going to find a decentralized system that's outside of society. Forget about it. Okay, the only if that actually worked, the only libertarians on the planet are Tasmanian tigers. They work completely independently, get together and eat a carcass, and then, you know, we're not, it's a total myth to treat ourselves that way. So you have to regard living in a system which is both centralized on the defense as a social system and decentralized, and that people within that social system can make independent decisions, but still framed by the society in which they exist.
Well, this whole system runs because we believe in currency. We believe a dollar is a dollar. We believe $100 is $100, right? But the moment you stop believing in that, or other countries stop believing in it, it's everything crumbles. So when you go back to the Roman Empire, one of the reasons why it fell was because what? They just kept taking out certain metals to devalue the currency. And when you see the United States printing 80% of its supply in the past 4 years, I believe other countries, and including people in the country, are looking at it and saying, well, I'm not believing in it like I once did. And I think
right,
that's appropriate.
That's what people think. Okay, but the people say 100% of fiat currencies have failed. What that really means is 100% of empires have failed. Okay, if you can maintain an empire, you're still going to have your fiat currency. It's part of the system. The Roman system failed. The Greeks failed. The Persians failed. The English failed. Okay, so it isn't the case that the currency leads to the failure of the empire. The failure of the empire terminates the currency.
Okay.
We've got an ask about tit. That's an Australian expression, in case you're wondering. A huge amount of our thinking about the world is ask about tit. We've got everything back to front. We have the effect. We think it's the cause. So a large part of what I'm trying to do is say, let's get our cause and effect right before we start talking about how to reorganize society, let alone, well, before we talk about how this society actually runs, let alone talking about reorganizing into another form of society.
So I didn't get into this world. I love how you're putting it, because you're not just bashing one side. You're bashing how it's.
I'm bashing the works.
You're bashing
everything.
You mentioned me
bashing Marx, for example. So I'll give some background to that.
Yes.
I led a student revolt at Sydney University in 1973 over the teaching of economics. Yeah. Successful revolt. It was the very first revolt against mainstream economics organized by students anywhere on the planet. And in the aftermath, the mainly lefties, okay, with left wing, definitely, and they decided to have a reading group to read Marx. And I'd only heard the word Marx at this stage. I was pretty, having been a critic of the mainstream economics by this point, you know, I wasn't about to be,
what,
I wasn't going to go
this?
From being.
The 70s?
1973.
So what, Milton Friedman was pretty big at that time, I think, somewhere in
there,
right?
Yep. Yeah, and like I met Paul Samuelson at this stage, okay? So even being in Sydney, and I was a critic of Paul Samuelson. But anyway, so we finished this revolt against teaching of mainstream economics, and the lefties decided to organize a Marx reading group. And all I knew about Marx was the argument that labor is the source of all value and that capitalists exploit the worker, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And I remember walking across to the reading group with a friend of mine. And at this stage, there was a huge housing building boom going on in Sydney. So you could see all these what are called kangaroo cranes. That's actually an Australian invention for building skyscrapers. They're globally used now. Yeah, the cranes that look like this, okay? Yeah, that's a kangaroo crane.
Oh, wow.
I said, I need a very good explanation from Marx as to why those things aren't adding value. Then we started reading Marx from chapter one of volume one of Capital all the way through the book. And I read it and I found this, what I thought was brilliant argument about what he called use value and exchange value. But the neoclassical theory talked about utility, marginal utility and marginal cost. And they argued that the marginal utility and marginal cost come together in the supply and demand curve to set prices. Marx instead argued that this theory said that the utility of whatever you're selling, like imagine I'm selling a COVID thing, okay? The person selling this loses utility when they give it away. And Marx said, well, that's nonsense. That's going back to a pre-capitalist period of exchange where you have a couple of societies where one can make something and the other can make something else and they don't know how they're made. Like those glass beads look really fabulous. So let's sell the whole of Manhattan to these Dutch people to get the glass beads. But he said, that's pre-capitalist. When you get to capitalist exchange, there's a production system churning out millions of these items. The person churning them doesn't lose any utility whatsoever. There's a gap between utility, use value, and exchange value. Not that that was brilliant. Marx then applied that to say that's where profit comes from labor. And I looked at it and thought, hang on, exactly the same argument applies to machinery. There will be a gap between the use value and exchange value. Machinery will also add value. Marx is wrong. Now, I got laughed at quite literally by the Marxists in the group. So I finally decided to go and do my master's thesis, reading through everything Marx ever wrote and finding where he developed that logic. And what I show is the labor theory of value, the argument that the rate of profit tends to fall, and the argument for socialism were all wrong. And I actually found the section where Marx realized that himself. And you can see him, like literally, I've got this brilliant new insight, gives me a fantastic foundation for my analysis. And holy shit, it argues that capital can also add value and therefore that revolution isn't going to happen. Holy fuck, what do I do? So he spends page after page after page trying to, you know, obfuscating words, trying to convince himself that his new analysis doesn't contradict the old analysis. And all the Marxists on the planet, bar me and about four or five others, fell for that load of verbal garbage. And so my point was saying, look, it's wrong. Marx has proven using beautiful logic that both labor and capital contribute to output. And that is a fallacy that there should have been a socialist revolution. So I'm about as popular with Marxists as I am with Austrian economists.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And anytime somebody bashes Marxism, I'm on board. But
you should read Marx. I mean, Marx is a great intellect, but he's stuffed up by believing in the labor theory of value. Okay. And if you read his original stuff, he was quite skeptical about it. But he got convinced by Ricardo and became what they call the Ricardian economist at that stage. And he's a very sophisticated thinker, much, much more so than most people realize. So I have far more respect for Marx, for example, than I have for Samuelson. Okay. But certainly Friedman. Okay. There's
wow.
far, far deeper capacity to read in Marx and understand his critics than I ever saw in Friedman. So, but again, people have chosen, the old expression, you throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, they hang on to the labor theory of value. They threw the baby away and hung onto the bathwater. And it's the Marxists that are in error, not Marx himself.
Well, it sounds
in
like
that
you,
sense.
You respect great orators, and Milton Friedman was great.
Great writers. Yeah, no, come on. Have you actually read some of his papers? He's a great speaker until you
great
read
speaker,
what he writes.
That's what I mean. He's great at it. He sums it up.
He's a great orator.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course.
Okay. Great. I agree with you. You're quite right. He's a great orator. And the people who can be oratorical and overwhelm you with verbal argument. But the trouble is I sit back there doing mathematical logic at the same time as I hear this stuff. And hang on a sec. That just doesn't make logical sense.
You're a capitalist. Am I right? You're a capitalist.
In a fundamental sense, I respect the freedom that capitalism gives to the growth of innovation and ideas. Okay, and that's something which certainly socialism did not do. There's a brilliant critic of socialism called Janos Kornai, a Hungarian economist, and he argued that the motivations in a socialist system with central planning and even without style, without all those things, that causes a low rate of innovation, which we saw. And so whereas capitalism inspires a high rate of innovation. And in that sense, I think the rate of innovation under capitalism is the second highest we've ever achieved in human civilization. The highest being back in the days when we were Cro-Magnon cavemen and stuff like that. And innovation was just something you did to be respected by your colleagues. So innovation has always been a human characteristic, but different societies promote or constrain innovation. And definitely capitalism is better than what socialism was, and feudalism certainly in terms of inspiring innovation over time.
Well, we talked a little bit about crypto. I want to touch on this because in my opinion, it's completely changed the way we look at money upside down. And so it'd be the fact that it's so volatile and how it's being, you know, valued at this point, maybe next week it's going to be potentially 15, 20% higher. It's insane.
Lower. Yeah, it is insane.
So can you tell me what you think about crypto, specifically Bitcoin, and where are we going with all this?
Yeah, look, I wish I'd bought Bitcoin when Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert first told me about it. I think I could have bought it for 10 quid. And I could have afforded to lose 1,000 quid and I would be a millionaire by now. So I'm sorry I didn't ride the bubble. Okay. But when they explained it to me, I thought this isn't money. Okay. Yeah. Because money is something you actually use for transactions. Now, if you have an object which is used for transactions, which appreciates in value, the last thing you want to do is actually use it.
Right.
So we talk about That's the weakness of it. It will never be money. People hang on to it. Like that whole thing, HODL. When I first saw it, I thought, oh, what is this? Oh, hey, hold on for dear life.
Yeah.
Okay. In other
HODL.
Words.
I heard that all two years ago, nothing but HODL, 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 HODL.
Yeah, yeah. That is an asset which is appreciating because other people think it's going to be worth more in the future. It's a speculative item. It's a Ponzi scheme. But it can just go on forever. I mean, the length of time that it's still succeeded without crashing is enormous. But the main thing that first made me decide not to, you know, fork out that 1,000 quid and buy 100 Bitcoin, which I could have bought more, I think, actually, given the price at the time, was the fact that it took 10 minutes to generate the nonce to enable a transaction to be added to the Bitcoin. And that meant enormous use of energy. And I thought, holy shit, given the energy we're already consuming, that is a silly way to get your security to enable the multiple ledgers not to be gamed. I said, it's going to come crashing down at some point. We'll realize we're using far too much energy. And the easiest things to do to when we start seeing true global warming catastrophes around the planet, realize, holy shit, we're in a serious predicament. The second easiest thing to get rid of is Bitcoin. The easiest to get rid of is tourism.
Truism?
Tourism. No more planes.
Got it.
No more jets. Okay. That'll be banned. Okay. And Bitcoin will go with it. So it'll be a great bubble until it probably will last until we start destroying the planet with the damage of global warming. And any skeptics out there, I'm happy to take you on. But this is Bitcoin being based on energy. That alone was a reason to say, look, I'm sorry, that is not a sustainable system for the future. And at the moment, the energy consumption of Bitcoin is roughly equivalent to Switzerland.
Steve, you sound brilliant. You know money. But for the fact of you saying you believe wholeheartedly in climate change, you're losing credit with our audience. Just so you know, I'm kidding.
I'm happy to do that because this is, I won the bet over the global financial crisis and I didn't want to win it. I sincerely do not want to be right about global warming. Okay. But the people I'm working with are the leading climate scientists on the planet and they are terrified. And we've been saying, okay, we tried to warn you a lot. You reckon it's not happening. We're going to sit back. We'll grab the popcorn and watch it, and see how you enjoy being wrong. Because we're not going to enjoy being right.
It's based on carbon in the air, right? That's what that's the whole argument. It goes back to that at all times. And my question to everybody who believes in climate change, which people call it global warming, obviously that doesn't make sense. Whenever you're in California right now and you're hitting a snowstorm, but how much
that's
of the environment
California
is
global, is it? I didn't realize California was a planet. Anyway, keep going. Sorry.
How much carbon is in the environment? What percentage of carbon is in the, or of the environment? How much, or what percentage is carbon? Do you know?
You mean in the atmosphere?
In the atmosphere, yeah.
Okay, 0.04%.
Yep, 0.03, 0.04, somewhere in there. Now, what is the correct amount? Nobody knows.
If you want to, sorry, you're talking of, I know scientists, mate. I know people who actually know the science behind this stuff. And the level of carbon dioxide in the planet was 278 parts per million, up to about 1700, 1750. It's been rising ever since then. Now, I actually saw a lovely analogy. People say, it's such a small amount, it can't have much impact. Do you want people to believe that one as well? You know, 0.04% is too small?
I'm one of those guys. We're on a ball, that's spinning 66,000 miles per hour, which is totally absurd to me. And I don't know if that's even real. But we're in space, right? And anything that's adjusted, even maybe a half of a degree, changes our climate. So for us to say we have control over it with lawnmowers,
Okay. Would you drink water in a swimming pool into which 13,000 people had pissed?
No, of course not.
Okay, that's 0.04%. Okay. Now,
all right. That's a great example. All right.
One of my friends just broke this one out, and he said it's a great analogy. Ask people whether they'll be willing to drink water in a swimming pool with 13,000 people that pissed.
Here's where your
it.
Argument goes wrong.
That gives it 0.04% of urine.
If carbon's bad for the environment, do you believe? And it doesn't sound like you're a wholehearted believer in God, but why would God give us all of this, what we have here? And every time we breathe, we give off carbon dioxide.
Carbon is just the most flexible chemical. You know, carbon can join bonds with four other atoms, and the next one up is silicon. It's the one which is the lightest, it's most effective for forming life forms. So we expect most life forms around the universe are going to be carbon based. Okay, but the thing is, carbon is what the temperature of the planet would be without carbon dioxide, by the way?
No.
Okay, minus 15 degrees would be the average temperature of the planet. Okay.
Wow.
What's called the albedo of the planet, the reflectivity of the Earth, is given where we are, at the distance we are from the sun, the radiation falling on us. If there weren't gases which trap radiation back, so radiation comes in at high frequency, it comes in at the ultraviolet and invisible spectrum. Again, it's absorbed by the Earth and then is reflected at the infrared, which we call heat. Okay. If you simply had albedo and the atmosphere we've got, but no greenhouse gases in it, we'd be at minus 15 degrees Celsius. Okay. Not minus 15 Fahrenheit, not quite that cold, but minus 15 Celsius. So without carbon dioxide, without water vapor, which amplifies carbon dioxide and methane and a whole range of other much smaller concentration chemicals, we'd be 13 degrees below the freezing point of water, the average temperature for the planet.
Wow.
Now that means, of course, there wouldn't be civilization. There probably wouldn't be life. Okay. So you need that a bit of warming to be above that level.
Hmm.
And being aware of the chemistry of that, that is why people are worried, because they know that the increasing level of carbon dioxide causes an increasing level of water vapor, which doubles the impact pretty much of one and a half times the impact of increasing carbon. So all these things are an essential part of the life cycle of the planet. And what we don't realize, and this is why one point I've just worked out recently that I now use in my presentations, when you take a look at where we fit in the long-term temperature history of the planet, forget about carbon dioxide. I'm not talking about that. Though there's a causal factor, obviously. We are in a glacial period in the planet. Okay, the temperature of the planet is such that with slight variations in our orbit around the sun and slight variations in the obliquity of the Earth's rotation and so on, we have cycles that are called Milankovitch cycles that increase or decrease the temperature and increase or decrease the amount of ice that exists on the planet. They're aperiodic, they're chaotic cycles, but fundamentally what you have is a long period of cold, and then because of the increasing coming closer to the sun and so on, a rising temperature, rising about 6 degrees, and then it falls again. And a long period, about 100,000 years long, roughly speaking, the peaks are a turning point. Okay, you're going up, you're going down, across the top is like it's flat. Okay, there have been three of those since we evolved as a species. Only in the last one have we built sedentary civilizations. So we've built a civilization on the top of a hill, fundamentally. Now, you look at the data, you can see we've been going down since about 3,000 years ago. Okay, we're on the turning point, heading down. So the temperature was highest about about 3,000 years ago, has been declining, and we would have been heading back down to being 6 degrees colder. This is centigrade, so it's like 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, if we fell 10 degrees Fahrenheit, are you in New York by any chance, or whereabouts in America?
I'm about 6 hours from New York.
North or south?
South.
Okay, well, you wouldn't be beneath a kilometer of ice, but any friends in the opposite direction, there'd be a kilometer of ice above their houses, okay? So if we let the normal climate cycle happen, we would be frozen out of existence. What we should have done is go horizontal when we hit the temperature of the Anthropocene, the very top of this Milankovitch cycle. We should have controlled the temperature at that level. If we didn't control it, we'd have gone down. Instead, we're blasting it up instead at 30 times the rate of change of the natural cycle. Now, that's suicidal. That's not natural. It's not rational. It's suicidal. And that's what we're doing right now.
I mean, you're giving a lot of power to politicians that say, we can take care of the climate. All you got to do is
politicians are the fucking idiots we need to get rid of. Okay.
Yeah. I can't believe you're on their side right now with climate change.
I'm not on their side. Those idiots are getting in the way of doing sensible policy. They're bloody posturers. And the trouble is they're swallowing the bullshit being put out by mainstream economists.
No, they're profiting from the bullshit. That's swallowing. They're profiting from it.
Probably. Okay. But they're probably at the top of the power system. But if what's going to happen is, you know what I think our future is going to be? Mad Max.
Yeah. Oh, that's exactly what I picture. I'm with you 100%.
Okay. But that's Mad Max because of global warming and because these idiot politicians have no idea of the impact. And the reason they have no idea is they're swallowing garbage being put out by mainstream economists, in particular William Nordhaus, who got that Nobel Prize in 2018 for his work on climate change. And it's the worst garbage I've read in 50 years of being a critic of economics. And yet his bullshit, they've all swallowed that stuff. And they think that's actually happening. Most politicians don't believe it's happening. They believe the economists. They're actually in a similar camp to you, climate change deniers, and saying, it doesn't really happen. It's going to matter in 80 years' time. That's somebody else's problem. I'm going to go along and make nice noises saying I believe in it, but really I'm going to bugger all. And that's what's actually happened. Now, climate scientists know what the hell they're talking about. They're terrified. Quite a few of them, I won't names here, but quite a few of them think we're going to see social breakdown this decade. A number think we'll make it to 2050, but quite a few of them, if we say we maintain this trajectory, human civilization will not see out this century. And the unawareness of the dangers we face is terrifying in the same sense that, you know, watching the idiots on the Titanic power through an area full of icebergs, pretending there are no icebergs. I'm sorry, there's one right ahead of us.
Well, when you talk about Mad Max, all you have to do is have a society that's totally reliant on technology and then take away the technology. So with electrical grids going down, it will just create an insane amount of chaos. And now you have Mad Max. That's all that needs to happen. Because if your banking system, if crypto, if your energy is dependent on electrical grid completely, no gas, all of a sudden gas, the price of it goes up. You create all these tribes and now you have all these armies and it's over.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the fear that I've got. That's where we're headed. And people who believe in capitalism are the ones who've got us in this situation.
Oh, come on.
No, I'm talking neoclassical economists William Nordhaus here, okay? Because they thought they were defending capitalism by attacking the critique done by the limits to growth. You ever heard of the limits to growth?
Yeah.
Okay, a study done by MIT engineers in 1972, arguing if you look at the trajectory we've gotten in resources, energy use, pollution, and so on and so forth, they said if we maintain these trends, we'll start running into serious ecological problems sometime in the 21st century. They were deliberately vague about when, but when you look at the plots and graphs they made, they said the turning point is about 2020 to 2030. Now, William Nordhaus rubbished their work. I wrote a paper called Measurement Without Data, kicked out their analysis, which was actually highly sophisticated engineering analysis, and substituted it with the bullshit that economists believe. And as part of that, to give you an idea of how stupid the guy is, and I do mean stupid, I'm quite happy to say that, he argued that 87% of American economy would be unaffected by climate change because it happens in what he called carefully controlled environments. Now, you look at what he meant by carefully controlled environments, he meant all of manufacturing, all of wholesale and retail services, all of the finance sector, most of real estate, what he meant by carefully controlled is under a roof. Okay. So he basically equated climate with weather. And that's the mistake that denialists make. And yet that's what's been accepted as the analysis by the mainstream. That's why we're screwed.
I think the mainstream is more so on your side in the United States. So
I don't know
what you're watching or reading, but yeah.
Well, you sound like CNN
right now, MSNBC. You're scaring me, Steve. You're scaring me.
I'm glad you should deserve to be scared, because if you're not scared, you're an idiot.
This has been entertaining. I knew it would be just by reading a little bit of your bio.
Yeah.
But when I saw Paul Revere Award, I'm like, all right, we're really going to, he's a freedom guy all the way. It sounds like you are, but you're leaning towards the left a lot in some of these last conversations, just saying.
Well, freedom is a word which is easily abused. Freedom is not an isolation. Freedom comes with responsibilities, and freedom comes with a complex system. And the real freedom we should be trying to maintain is the freedom for life to exist on this planet. And we just disparage life. We exploit the animal systems. We trivialize the biology of the system. This is an incredible miracle that we actually live in the first place. And what we really should be doing is respecting life and trying to find ways to maintain life in general, rather than ignoring the other species on the planet, which is what we've done.
I think you've read way too much Karl Marx. You've been listening to Dr. Fauci a little bit too long, and you've been watching too much news. But I still like you, Steve, just so you know. Fascinating stuff.
Well, I like you too, but I know you're wrong.
So guys, check out his book, Steve King, definitely an entertaining guy. He has 150 reviews on Amazon with his new book, The New Economics, A Manifesto. Yeah, now I know where you get that word, a manifesto. So guys, look him up. Fascinating dude, and really knows his stuff when it comes to money. Maybe not the other stuff, but definitely money. So great honor to have you, Steve. And is there a website or a social media channel that you recommend?
I have two. I have a Substack and a Patreon page. So if you search for www.patreon.com/ProfSteveKeen or ProfSteveKeen.substack.com, you'll find my work there.
Beautiful. Last question. Do you believe in the moon landing? Do you think human?
I watched it on TV.
Oh, okay. Don't even tell me that's your reason for believing it. Are you serious?
No, I know. I know engineers. I know people who work for NASA.
Steve,
if you think they could fake that thing, I'm sorry.
I can fake it incredible. In my basement right now, just so you know.
Yeah, you can right now. You try doing it with 1969 technology. Okay. The first computer games weren't invented till after,
Nixon on his landline and talked to space cadets supposedly 22,000 miles away. I don't know. So we'll talk about that next time. But anyway, guys, check them out. Steve King.
Okay. Bye-bye. Have fun.
Remember, guys, $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.